At age 81, Dwight Chapin has decided for the first time to write about his years in politics and the White House, which happened over 50 years ago. His book is called The President's Man, The Memoirs of Nixon's Trusted Aide. In his first chapter, Chapin writes, quote, "I knew Richard Nixon well. I started working as an organization field man during his California gubernatorial campaign. I became an advance man at the beginning of 1966, the off-year election cycle, and then his personal aide in 1967. Chapin then continued, "In the White House, I served as appointment secretary. I had the office next to him." Unquote. However, his time working for Richard Nixon didn't end well. Dwight Chapin, the name Dick Tuck, what does that mean to you?
Well, it instantly means to me a Democratic prankster. Dick Tuck was a character, one of a kind. And I actually was a friend of Dick Tuck's. We got along, knew each other, ran into each other at various events. I never forget running into him at a Republican convention, and he had every conceivable credential available hanging around his neck, more so than most of my friends had. But anyway, he was a Democratic prankster, pulled any number of different shenanigans on Nixon and on other Republicans over the many years.
I interviewed him in 1996. I want to run a 50-second clip from that interview, and then we'll continue talking about Dick Tuck.
I didn't go to the debate. He was covered there. But I went to Memphis, and that's where Nixon was to go the next morning. Well, I was there, and the plane landed. In those days, we used to come down a ramp, you know, in the good old days. You had fresh air when you even had fresh air in airplanes then. And a wonderful matronly lady with a big Nixon button. The camera started to roll, ran up and kissed him, and she said, "Don't worry, Mr. Nixon." She said, "You lost last night, but he'll beat you next time." Well, his face dropped. And so, well, a week later, Time magazine reported since I was there that this, you know, that this, I suppose we'd call it spin control now or something, that I had something to do with that old lady who had the pin on and who made the...
Did you?
Well, I probably did.
Dick Tuck had what impact on your life?
Well, Dick Tuck had a huge impact on my life in the sense that one morning in February of 1971, I was called into the Oval Office, and the president was sitting there along with Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, and they said to me, "Do you know anybody that can do Dick Tuck type activities for us in the upcoming 1972 campaign?" And I thought about it and went out and recruited my good friend Don Segretti to do Dick Tuck activities. So that was at the epicenter of what became the episode that involved my aspect of being involved in the thing we call Watergate.
So what happened after you hired him?
After I hired Don Segretti, Don went out and did a number of different what we would call Dick Tuck type things, which were basically pranksterism type activities on Democratic candidates. And the important thing from my point of view was that I had hired Don to do this, and he went out as a free agent. And for the most part, what he did, I was not knowledgeable about. As my book makes clear, Don was on his own, basically, and I was busy with planning the trip to China and to Russia and other presidential duties.
Did you personally ever have responsibility for paying him?
I did not pay Dick Tuck. He was paid by Herb Kalmbach, and that arrangement was made by Gordon Strachan. Gordon Strachan was another White House assistant to Bob Haldeman, and Gordon had been a fraternity brother of Don Segretti's at USC. And once the decision was made that we would use Don, I turned over the payment responsibilities and how all that would work to Gordon, who then worked it out with Herb Kalmbach.
Seems like one of the issues was whether or not Donald Segretti ever reported to you on some of the dirty tricks that he conducted, and which led to a grand jury situation where you testified and he testified. Is that where you were caught allegedly lying about your relationship with him?
Yes. What happened on that was that when Don testified to a grand jury, he said that when I hired him, one of the reasons that Dwight hired him was because he was a lawyer and he would know what was right and what was wrong. So when that happened, it made it almost impossible for them to indict me for anything that Don did. But the prosecutors took me to a grand jury and asked me a series of questions about Don and his activities. There were some things that Don had done that indeed I was either semi-aware of or had some piece of knowledge that he had done that. And when they asked me particular questions, I responded not to the best of my knowledge or not that I recall, thinking they were going to ask me more questions, and they never did. And so what ended up happening was I got indicted for basically sloppy answers to the questions that they ask me. I've got it detailed in the book. It's obviously complex and hard to get across in a couple of minutes here, but it was definitely my responsibility to tell the truth. And it appeared, and obviously it appeared to the grand jury, that I had hedged on the truth, and therefore that's why I was indicted.
Did his answer to questions before the grand jury have anything to do with ending up getting you indicted?
Not that I'm aware of. I really have never read Don's testimony to the grand jury, but I'm not aware of his saying anything that led directly to my indictment. My indictment was because of the way I answered questions, not for anything that Don did.
The reason I ask you these questions about Donald Segretti and the grand jury is that if it hadn't been for Dick Tuck and it hadn't been for the president wanting dirty tricks in the campaign of 72, and it hadn't been for your friend Donald Segretti, would you have gone to prison?
No. Absolutely not. But I do want to say that the president, it was not that the president wanted dirty tricks in the campaign. It was that the president was reacting to what had happened to him over many years and the kinds of activities of shenanigans that were pulled on him. And he wanted us to be pulling some shenanigans too. So the whole dirty tricks thing in my mind kind of gets everything out of proportion to what it really was. I mean, some of the stuff was incredibly humorous and was not designed to cause any kind of actual harm to a candidate.
Do you think that is necessary in politics?
I believe it is. No, I do not believe it is necessary in politics, but I do believe it happens continually. We have stories every election cycle about some shenanigans that are going on.
You say in your book that, and I don't have a direct quote in front of me, but you say that Richard Nixon was paranoid. Give us your own sense of what paranoid meant to you and when you saw it in him.
Well, I think the joke is something like even paranoids have the right to be paranoid or something. I have always pushed back on the idea that Nixon was paranoid. I believe it's a stick that people have hit him with over the many decades of his career. What he was very apprehensive about motives and about the motives of the press and the Eastern liberal establishment. And he was overly cautious to the point that he would suspect something was happening before it might even happen. And so the easy way to do it was to put a label on it and call him paranoid. I deal with that in The President's Man, quite extensively.
Why did you want to write a book at your age?
I wanted to write a book at my age because I think I'm at a better age to write a book and to look back over the history of my own career and my life with Richard Nixon. So many of the books that are written come immediately after somebody walks out of the White House door. I mean, it's like 10 minutes later, we have a book on the shelf. I waited. Many people over the years had heard my stories or talked to me about various aspects of my White House career and felt, hey, why don't you write a book? And I had been thinking about it. And then what happened was one of my grandchildren came to me. We were visiting in Kansas City. And there was a little knock on the door, and my grandson, who was probably 7 or 8 at that time, looked up at me, and he calls me Pips. And he said, Pips, did you work for a president? And I said, yes, Matthew, I did. And he said, but did you go to prison? And I said, yes, I did, Matthew. And he said, well, did the president go to prison too? And I mean, this little voice, and I invited him in to sit on the bed. And I said, Matthew, someday when you get older, I'm going to tell you the whole story. And that was really a trigger point for me. I felt that it was necessary for two major reasons. One, for my family and the generations of my children, grandchildren that are to come, for them to know what happened to their grandfather and great-grandfather. But more importantly, I had found in terms of talking to people over time that I had stories and knowledge and information on Richard Nixon that gave a different viewpoint of the man, not to be defensive of him. That was one thing that I wanted to make sure I avoided in my book. I wanted to tell what I knew about him. I wanted to give the history of the man who I saw, what he was about, and why I thought certain things that happened to him transpired.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Several times in your book, you talk about mentors, and one of them was Richard Moore. I don't know. I can't remember whether you called Bob Haldeman a mentor or not, but you certainly said you were very close friends of his. What did you look for in a mentor, and what did they do for you?
One of the blessings of my life has been the number of mentors I've had over the years, and the tremendous gift they have been to my career. Bob Haldeman probably would be one of the key people to mention, because he took me as a very young man and tutored me and brought me along and actually made my whole involvement in the world of Nixon possible. Then there was Herb Kalmbach, who was the person that first hired me in 1972. And he advised me on my career all the way through the White House and then on into later life. Richard Moore, you mentioned, and Dick was a senior person in the White House with phenomenal judgment. And a lot of my mentors that I went to, keep in mind, I was a very young man when I came into the White House. I was in my late 20s, and we had these more senior men around that I would go to for advice and for counsel, and who, by the grace of God, were kind enough to help shape my career. Tex McCrary, one of the great public relations men of all time, he trained Barbara Walters and Bill Sapphire and any other number of people, and Tex became one of my great mentors. He was never on the White House staff, but he was of counsel to us, not even in a paid position, and we would tap his reservoir of knowledge, and he was one of my mentors. So, you know, how did all this happen? For some reason, these men were kind enough to share their experience and their wisdom with me, and by the grace of God, I got it.
You do, though, in your book say that Richard Moore, who was one of your mentors, lied to you.
Yes, well, Richard Moore was part of a small group of men, to include the President of the United States, John Ehrlichman, Bob Haldeman, and John Dean, who came to a conclusion while I was on a vacation in Ireland after the 1972 campaign. They came to the conclusion that I would be leaving the White House. And Dick Moore was involved in that. And when I went to talk to him after I learned that I was going to have to leave the White House, he never told me that he had been involved in these conversations. In fact, he acted surprised. Now, I've been around politics long enough, and I have learned enough to know that sometimes men have to be a part of a decision-making process and have to hold that in confidence, even when some young man comes in and expects them to be telling them what in this case would have been the truth. And I cleared the air with Dick. I let him know that I knew that he had not been truthful with me, and he apologized to me. We were at a luncheon together with my friend Henry Cash and the three of us when all this came up. And Dick apologized, and I said, "Dick, I forgive you. I understand how it works and why you had to manage it the way you did." And, of course, my book is full of a lot of different stories that where we find these kinds of contradictions or ways that it works when you're in the White House. And it's not always pretty. I mean, there are situations like this that happen, and they have to be dealt with, and they appear so much different when you put the public light on them.
You were not involved in Watergate. My memory is you didn't testify before the committee, or did you?
I never appeared before the official Watergate committee. My activities were limited strictly to the TikTok pranksterism type stuff.
You report to us that the FBI came to see you in your office to interview you, and the next morning it ended up on the front page of the Washington Post. What was the interview about, and how did it get to the Post within 24 hours?
That's a remarkable story to me. I had, I believe it was on October 10th, a Sunday, there was a front page story on the Washington Post that tied me into Don Segretti, and the story was a very explosive one that also tied both Don and me into the activities by the committee to reelect the president and Gordon Liddy and the whole Watergate group. I mean, it was an expose that was really rocked us. And I can remember thinking, what in the world is going on here? I mean, the story itself, the way that it spun itself out did not seem to me to be truthful. But it ended up being the litmus point in terms of leading to my having to leave the White House, because all of a sudden I was a victim, if you will, or in this case a participant by hiring Don Segretti, and it was directly linked to the president. Now, I'm not sure, Brian, if I completely answered your question. Can you help me recall exactly what your ending part was?
Yeah, what I was interested in is how in the world were you interviewed by the FBI in your office one day and the information got out to the Post the next day?
Yeah, okay, thank you very much. What happened was, so that story ended up on that Sunday. On Tuesday, I was told that the FBI wanted to talk to me, and the meeting was not in my office. It was in John Dean's office. John Dean left the office, and his deputy, Fred Fielding, stayed there. And the FBI asked me probably for an hour all about the story that had been in the Sunday paper. And I answered every question, and to the best of my knowledge, I answered every question honestly. Then the next morning, that details of that interview were in the Washington Post. And the agents came back a couple of days later, and they wanted to ask some follow-up questions, and they spent the first 10 minutes talking to me and apologizing, letting me know they had no idea how that information had ended up in the Washington Post. Well, obviously, we came to find out later that there was Deep Throat, who was Mark Felt, who was the number two guy at the FBI, and that when the agents had gone back from the interview on Tuesday and passed their notes on into the chain of command, they went all the way up to Mark Felt, and he leaked it to the men at the Washington Post.
You know, we never saw any outrage about the fact that the number two guy at the FBI was leaking to the Washington Post. Do you have any idea why not?
Well, because, first of all, at that time, we didn't know where the leaks were coming from. We did not know until much later that that Mark Felt, the number two guy at the FBI, was leaking the information. And of course, it's outrageous, in my opinion. And of course, and we have learned in recent time that that there's a lot of cleaning up to be done at the FBI. This leaking thing was a pattern, and it evidently went back into the Hoover days. Now, I came from the school of being a little boy who ran to his radio set every afternoon after school to listen to This Is the FBI on the radio, and grew up believing in the integrity and the honesty and everything else of the FBI. So to me, this leaking by the top brass of the FBI was not only outrageous, it was unlawful. They had taken an oath to defend the Constitution, and in my opinion, did not live up to it.
You mentioned that John Dean was in the office with the FBI, and you say some...
John left.
He did leave. Okay.
John, the agents came in. John was there along with Fred Fielding, and then John excused himself and left. I am talking about the October, it would have been like October 12th or 13th, whatever that date was. John did not stay for that interview.
Again, what I'm getting at is, and in your book, you are really critical of John Dean. You point your finger at him. You suspect that he was, for whatever reason, out to get you. And I want to give you a chance to talk about that. And again, it goes back to the Dick Tuck, the Don Segretti, the meeting with the president, the dirty tricks, and then John Dean. And why did they want to get you?
I don't believe that John Dean wanted to get me. I believe that John Dean got himself into a situation where he had to defend himself and do everything possible to keep himself afloat. And that is what my book is about, and that is what is significant in my book. We prove without a doubt in our exhibits in the back of the book. We have conversations of Dean with the president where Dean is not forthcoming to the president. In fact, on the tape that is known as the Cancer on the Presidency tape, we hear John Dean say, sir, you know, I need to tell you everything that's been going on because you don't know. This is 9 months after Watergate happened. He's been meeting with the president, talking to the president, and all of a sudden he tells him he needs to fill him in on what the truth actually is. And the other thing is that in 1974, I found an FBI report that is in the appendix. It hadn't been hidden. Nobody ever publicized it or sat and focused on it. But this FBI report that was done to the director, which documents the FBI's participation in the whole Watergate episode, labels John Dean, they used the term, the master manipulator of Watergate. And so my book does not apologize for Richard Nixon. It does not try to change all of the history of so much of Watergate, but what we do is we position John Dean right where he belongs at the very outset of the entire Watergate matter. He could have told the truth and corrected it, and the president would have never had to leave office. But John Dean was more interested in protecting himself.
You say that after you spent 9 months in Lompoc prison in California, the only person that wrote you after it was over was John Dean. Why did he write you, and what was your reaction to it?
It was a wire, a telegram, which were used back in that era. And it was from John and Mo Dean wishing me well, the fact that I was getting out of Lompoc that day, and wishing me well. I have no idea why it came, other than I would hope that there was a little guilt in his mind about where I had been spending 9 months.
Have you talked to either Donald Segretti or John Dean since those days?
I have not talked to John Dean. Don Segretti and I are wonderful friends. We are in touch with each other constantly. When we're in California, I try to have dinner with him and with his lovely wife. They're wonderful people. And Don was a victim of circumstances, was very hurt. Don basically did absolutely nothing wrong. And I have always felt bad that I got him into this Dick Tuck role and the consequences that he faced.
I want to run some audio of an interview I did with Tim Naftali about his interview with you. And anybody that wants to see those interviews, I assume, can get them through the Nixon Library, but also they're on YouTube, of you sitting with Naftali for how long, by the way?
I believe Tim interviewed me for 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah, I watched 3 hours of it, I know for sure, so that if there's others there, I didn't see it. But anyway, here's Tim Naftali talking about you.
He came to the interview, which we did in New York, ready to talk and to preserve his story. It was an amazing interview. It got Chapin, I believe, into trouble among his colleagues and led to a controversy for the oral history program, because Chapin said something on tape that he did not say to the Senate, he didn't say in the trial, and something that the Nixon group had always denied.
That was?
And that was that it was Richard Nixon who was there when the Dirty Tricks campaign was ordered, that Nixon was too smart to order it, but he was sitting in the room with Haldeman. It was done in Haldeman's office, which is why it wasn't taped.
Your reaction?
First of all, Haldeman and the president talked to me in the Oval Office. And I never, ever hid anything. I even told the grand jury when I was called in there that the president and Bob Haldeman were the ones that wanted me to find a Dick Tuck. That has always been part of the official record. There, you cannot find anyone that would say that in some way I got, quote, in trouble or whatever else with other Nixon people because of the fact that this was hidden and I exposed it. Let me tell you this. I did go to prison because I was convicted by a jury in Washington, D.C., of committing perjury in their opinion. I have never felt that I did, but the jury in Washington, D.C. did feel that I committed perjury. I have focused, particularly after going through this episode, on my trustworthiness, my honesty, and that is what I have tried to do in this book. I have reached within myself to make certain that to every degree possible, every word in my book, The President's Man, is truthful. And what Tim Naftali is saying on that tape is not truthful.
Let me ask you about Tim Naftali for a moment. I've interviewed him several times, and he's been on. The people, and you know them, you mentioned them in your book, were furious at the Nixon Foundation Library that Tim Naftali was running it. What is your view? You know, you're not in the – I don't think you're on the board, are you?
I am not on the board, but I'm sure well aware of all of the issues that are confronted with this particular issue.
I mean, if you just look at Tim Naftali, the person, he could not be more on the, I don't want to go through the details on it, but he's everything that Richard Nixon wasn't, whether that's good or bad. And I'm talking about politics and lifestyle and all that stuff. What impact did it have on you that he became the head of that library for a long time? And I know the people that you know well there were just beside themselves that he was there.
Yes, I think it was a big mistake on the part of the leadership of the National Archives in Washington, D.C. to put Naftali into Yorba Belinda to run the archives section of the Nixon Library. And that was a mistake that was made for whatever political reasons. Everybody has walked around the Nixon Library like they were walking on hot coals because of the controversy over Watergate and all that happened with Nixon and with his men. The great news is that David Ferriero, the National Archivist of the United States of America, he is a Democrat, and in my book, I praise him. This man is absolutely sensational. And he grabbed a hold of that library after Tim Naftali left, and he reorganized it. He put great leadership in place. The working relationship between the independent Nixon Foundation and the government side of the National Archives could not be better. It worked smoothly. We did a $20 million renovation of the Nixon exhibits. I happen to have been appointed by the board of directors to chair and run that operation, and we had nothing but cooperation with the National Archives, and the legacy of Tim Naftali at the Nixon Library is ancient history, and we all hope it disappears forever.
Talk about how you did this book.
The book was written by utilization of my diaries that I kept during the period that I worked in the White House, by all of the memorandums and materials that were collected that are part of the National Archives and are available in Yorba Belinda, and by a treasure trove of letters between Bob Haldeman and myself, over 150 letters that Joe Haldeman, Bob's wife, gave to me after Bob passed away. They were the letters that I had written to Bob in the early days of working with Richard Nixon. Plus, I had a gentleman by the name of David Fisher, who has worked with many authors over the years, and David had a system. He interviewed me over 30 times for 3 to 4 hours a session. We had over 800 pages of notes, and he would not only take an issue, but he would ask me, he would probe, how were you feeling? How did you feel when this happened to you? How did you feel when the president told you to go do whatever it might be, or when Haldeman got upset at me, or what, you know, just really dug in. And so the way that we got the book together was by taking all of this material, getting it organized. David Fisher had a system for working with kind of a card file system, and he put together a first draft, and then I took the draft along with my wife Terry Goodson, who also, by the way, had worked in the Nixon White House, and we spent weeks reworking the drafts, and then I had 3 or 4 friends that I had picked to be readers, and we massaged it, and that's the book. That's the book that's coming out.
By the way, in the sometime in your life, and I don't want to go into great detail, you were married to a woman named Susie. Is that right?
Yes, Susie Howland Chapin.
And you're now married to another woman. Did this experience of Watergate have an impact on that first marriage?
I think that the impact of Watergate, coupled with, you know, all of the other things that happen in life, yes, it had an impact. But there were other extenuating reasons for Susie and I separating. She was an absolutely wonderful person, and it was a sad thing all around, as most divorces are.
What impact did this experience at the White House have on the rest of your life?
The impact of working at the White House afforded me an absolutely fantastic life. I say that I feel so fortunate that it happened to me when I was such a young man, and not as it did with many of the other men when it was the capstone of their careers, because I was able to take all of the lessons that I learned, positive and negative, and to use them as building blocks throughout my life. And I've had a very enriched, wonderful life, one that is full of family and friends and unique experiences. And that it was that base at the White House that gave me that phenomenal footing to build the rest of my life.
You talked about the impact of God on your life, and this just kind of popped out at me as I was reading your book, that you, Bob Haldeman, and Mr. Ehrlichman were all Christian Scientists. What did that have to do with your relationship during the White House years?
Not much. Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, were much more devout Christian Scientists than I was. I went to a Christian Science Sunday school because my mother's parents were Christian Science, and my mother taught Christian Science Sunday school. But by the time I was into my early teen years, I was going to Presbyterian church. I went to the Methodist church. I went to the Union church. I was focused on going to places of worship where the minister became the important thing more than the ideology, if you will, of the religious beliefs. I operated off of, and I still do, I love messages. I love Dr. Norman Vincent Peale and his power of positive thinking. And so I acclimated that way much more so than to the Christian Science beliefs, although I do believe that many of the tenets of Christian Science are healthy and healthy for me in terms of my mental attitude.
This is just an observation, and I want your reaction to it. As you watched everybody go through that period, whether it's Haldeman, Ehrlichman, well, I could list a number of other people. The only one that I would question who seemed to be anxious for a fight all the time was Chuck Colson. All these guys are dead. And as you look back on the administration, if it weren't for the mental attitude of Richard Nixon, would the rest of you all have done what you did? In other words, was he led the, and you did it, say in your book that he was somewhat paranoid, and that he was always had enemies and fighting everybody. And if you read the memos that came out right after he was president and Bruce Otis's book, you see how he was furious and angry about the media all the time. Would the rest of the people that you knew there be like they were if he hadn't been the leader?
What a wonderful question. I guess the truth is I don't know. We served a man who was our leader, who was opinionated. But I think one of the things that's key in my book is understanding what made that man tick and where that anger and resentment came from. And also, I think there is a over-exaggeration of how intensely partisan, if you want to use that word, or angry he was. Each one of these incidences, and I don't want to make any excuses for him, but you have to put into context when he writes or dictates a memorandum and so forth, what are all of the other aspects of what was going on at that particular moment, and what caused the reaction that you are reading and reacting to all these years later, what was really behind that. And I believe that we're seeing any number of historians, whether it's Conrad Black and his book, or Evan Thomas and his book, or Farrell and his book, these Michael Dobbs, all these people are looking at this a little different now. So we're getting more information. I had a unique experience with the historian Douglas Brinkley and Luke Nichter, where they said, you know, this book is filled with new details on almost every page, and we're learning new things, and it's going to force us to reassess Richard Nixon once again. So, you know, not that you're using stereotypes, but there's just a lot of stereotyping of Richard Nixon, the paranoid thing being one. And yes, I do use that term in the book, but I modify it significantly, and I try to give it perspective, because Richard Nixon was anything but evil. He was an incredibly good man. One of my talking points for some talks that I'm going to be given is kind of a unique one, because I think Richard Nixon is just one incredible role model for young men. I got an email from a young person working on the Hill who is in the foreign policy arena and works for a Democratic congressperson. And that this young man had studied Chinese, gone to Peking to study, and wrote me because his role model in terms of where his aspirations in the field of foreign policy are Richard Nixon. And it blew me away. And I think we're going to see more and more of a recognition that this man is a lot more balanced and had a lot more to offer our country than some of the ways it's been characterized.
A couple of quick things. You worked around this man for how many years?
I worked around him for 20 years.
You grew up where?
I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, and then moved to Southern California when I was 14.
I asked you about the religious connection earlier. How about the fraternity connection with guys like Ron Ziegler and others? You were Sigma Chi, you were president of the fraternity, and you had others that worked around you. How significant is that, not just in the Nixon administration, any administration where people are a part of networking?
Well, I think the networking part of the political situation is huge, whether you're talking about the people from Georgia that came up with Jimmy Carter, or whether you're talking about the collection of Californians that were with Ronald Reagan. I mean, the Texans with the Bushes. I mean, it's endless. But really, the Sigma Chi aspect of at USC it's interesting because Sandy Quinn, who was actually in the Reagan administration, was Nixon's assistant press secretary under Herb Klein in the 1962 gubernatorial campaign. Sandy was kind of the ringleader of the Sigma Chi group that got involved with Richard Nixon in 1962, and that involved Ron Ziegler, Tim Elborn, but really not me. I came in through a different door. I was hired by Herb Kalmbach and Bob Haldeman, and Sandy was not involved in that hiring. But it was interesting that there were so many Sigma Chi's involved that go back for so many years.
I could talk to you a lot longer, but you've got other things to do, I'm sure, Dwight Chapin. And the name of this book is called The President's Man, The Memoirs of Nixon's Trusted Aide. Dwight Chapin's an appointment secretary and a lot of other things for Richard Nixon in the White House. And you can read that account in the book. And we thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Brian. It's been terrific.
Thanks for listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.